Oh yeah, it sure does feel good to be back home. Did I miss the cold? I don't think so. Arizona was full of snow and the Big Apple had us in thermals. What's good, everyone? This is Schmitty with another episode of Talkin' Schmidt. Today on the show, we're going to the punk rock scene and interviewing Chris Rest. Chris was in one of my favorite bands growing up, RKL, also known as Rich Kids on LSD. And now he plays in the Fat Records band Lagwagon. Stoked to get this one finally done and looking forward to a follow-up with the good homie Little Joe Raposo, who's also in the band. If you don't know, hold on, let's do this proper. Let's do this proper, mate. I was going to do this proper, eh? If you don't know, RKL was a group of friends that started playing in the Santa Barbara area and later did some time in San Francisco. These guys were a huge inspo to me and my bros in high school and all the way into adulthood. You know, even right now, songs like Keep Positive, Beautiful Feeling, Dead Teds, Into the Rock and Roll Nightmare, Sarcastic Jester, Break the Camel's Back, their influence is heavy. Just ask most bands on Fat Records and any drummer out there trying to emulate the great Bomber. I interviewed the lead singer, Jason Sears, before he passed for Thrasher Magazine. I'm not sure what year that was, but I've seen them play a lot, including a show in Santa Barbara with the Ramones. Anyways, I can go on about these guys forever. I love RKL. But before we start, I want to give a shout out to our new advertiser, John Joseph Van Landingham of Southern Georgia, who has been skating since 1986 and blowing glass since 96. His glass is homemade in the USA, and you can find out more info from him on his Instagram or his Facebook. Someday he may even have one of them OG websites to peep. Anyway, I'm super hyped. He reached out to me and stoked to get someone who's down for the cause. So with that, John Joseph Van Landingham, keep it going. And like Albino says, provoke the stoke.
Provoking the stoke.
Also, I want to give a big shout out to Michael, who ran me down in the Upper West Side. We were going to the Seinfeld Diner and he ran me down and said, "Hey man, I love the show. Been following you since Epically Trife days." Him and his daughter took some photos and it was cool. Cheryl was stoked. She's been telling anyone that'll listen that her husband got ran down in New York for a little fan out situation.
Frisco icon.
Big props, man. Thank you.
Shout out.
So yeah, anyway, we are always down for advertising to help support what we're doing here.
Blood Wizard. Blood Wizard. Blood Wizard. Blood Wizard! Shop.bloodwizard.com.
Tickety-tack.
Hey, it's Corey at Blue Plate, 3218 Mission Street. Come see us. Meatloaf, fried chicken, deviled eggs, Dollar Olympia beers. We're here every day of the week. We got a garden and we got smiles on our faces. Come let us make you happy.
So if you're interested in advertising yourself, you'd be surprised at the low, low prices. Hit me up, talkinschmidt@gmail.com, or just DM me on the Instagram. Whatever works for you, it works for me. Northern California, we finally got it basketball-wise. April 15th marks Golden State versus Sacramento for the first time ever in playoff atmosphere. I got to be honest, we're going to put out the beam. Sorry about you, Sac. Okay, so before we get to Chris, I just want everyone to listen to the words of this song that was written in the 80s and applies even more today.
Yeah!
a grin. Think positive. Shout out to Rob Washburn at PAL. Good catching up with you and talking early RKL. You were there at Jason Sears Vert Ramp, no doubt. Hope you guys enjoy this one, and I hope to be back next week. Busy life, kids, keeps me away from the podcast life sometimes. Peace.
Hey, I'm Chris Rest, and you're listening to Talkin' Schmidt podcast.
Hey,
Talkin' Schmidt.
I'm already not watching.
It's cool, like tonight is the night.
Damn, this is like the coolest thing I'm ever gonna do.
I wouldn't say it was fun.
What do you mean? Well, Christian Fletcher's younger brother.
Fuck the Dodgers.
Our big dog's in. What do you think, Dolan?
We on? Schmidt?
Talkin' Schmidt.
Alpha Macaroni.
Most of these guys, their opinion don't matter.
Talkin' Schmidt, right?
It's skateboarding.
I remember that.
Talkin' Schmidt.
What are Yuns doing?
Holy shit.
Skateboarding homies.
No, Schmidt, you can't jump in.
What is happening?
I'm here for Greg Smith. Yay!
Gregory.
Yes, we are.
Wi-Fi check one, Wi-Fi check two.
All right, here we go. I just got to say before we start this that I'm super fired up. I've been a fan of RKL since, I think, 1984. And I've been talking to Chris for a little while, trying to get him here on the podcast. And our schedules have finally aligned and we got this going. But when we're talking about Rich Kids on LSD, who started in 1982, from Keep Laughing all the way through to Riches to Rags in 94 and into Lagwagon and even into the 2022 release of the live album, there's only one consistent member, and that's this guy right here. Thanks for joining us, Chris. Hyped that we got to get this going.
Me too, thanks.
Where were you born and you were raised down in Ventura area, Oxnard maybe, or Goleta?
I was born in San Gabriel area. Sierra Madre Canyon is where my parents lived when I was a little kid or baby. And my dad was a musician when he was in high school. He played in a bluegrass band, and his dad owned a camera shop in San Gabriel, and my dad worked there, and he told me he used to give guitar lessons at a local music shop. He tried to get me to play guitar over the years, but he played acoustic guitar, and I remember as a little kid it just hurt my fingers, and it just never caught on until I picked up an electric guitar. But I played some piano. My mom started me off on piano, and I actually played drums before I actually got into guitar.
At what age?
I started playing drums at probably 11, and then I got an electric guitar at 13.
Damn. Okay. And
now
so
I'm 55 now. I should be a virtuoso, I think.
Was the drums, do you think that early bit of drums helped you kind of like realizing anything as far as composing songs or just any of that kind of stuff? I know how important drums and bass are as the backbone. And then when you're playing guitar, maybe having that realization kind of helped you figure out where you need to be.
I think piano was a perfect starting point because everything's linear and with guitar, it's kind of like having six separate keyboards on top of each other. It makes it super confusing for a beginner. But drums and real understanding tempo and dividing beats up into quarters and sixteenths and 32nds and triplets and all that stuff was really useful too. I think the foundation of piano and drums really helped me out a lot.
And so, RKL, was it you and Jason meet first, or did you meet Bomber? Or I mean, you guys are like 12 and 13 years old when this all goes down, right?
Not when RKL started, but when I met Jason, I was probably 12 or 13. He was on my soccer team.
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't meet Bomber until right before junior high school. And my mom moved to Summerlin, California, which is basically in Santa Barbara, but it was just a little beach town, and Bomber showed up there. He was best friends with the son of the guy who owned the property we were renting, and so Bomber was just like a permanent fixture. He basically came with the property, and I remember he had a bad limp when I first met him because he had broke his knee or somehow dislocated something with his knee at a skate park in Santa Barbara called Golf and Fun. And he always used to complain about that. He'd go, oh, that little mini half pipe was so badly designed and whatever. And he blamed it on the skate park while he busted his knee. But like I had a friend named Sean that used to come over and play drums, and I'd play guitar, and we had one of my other friends would just sing into the boom box that we had set up on the bookshelf, and he would just make stuff up and we'd jam and make little recordings, and Bomber would come over, and Bomber, any instrument that he picked up, he just instantly just perfected it. I don't know, it's crazy. And like, so my friend Sean had been playing drums for quite a while, and I mean about a year, and Bomber let me try, and it was just instantly like blazing, and it was crazy. And him and Jason were both good at everything. It was ridiculous.
Was Jason already, was like, what years was this? Was snowboarding happening, or is that later?
Let's see. This was probably 80, 81. So I think maybe Tom Sims had started snowboarding a little bit. And I'm not, I guess snowboarding was starting to become a thing. I can't really remember when that started.
What's your influences right then?
Well, I didn't have any older siblings to tell me what was cool or what wasn't. And so it was difficult for me to figure out what to buy at the record store. I remember just choosing records because of the album cover.
Yeah, I'm saying.
For the most part, that worked until I bought Meatloaf Bat Out of Hell, and I was severely disappointed. I like the record now, but as a 12-year-old kid, I was like, oh man, bogus. And but I used to, my mom listened to FM radio a lot, and so I was into, that's how I learned about Led Zeppelin and AC/DC and Cheap Trick, and the Cars were like my two favorite bands. We did have this one tenant that was renting a room from my parents who had a record collection and said, yeah, anything you want to hear, go ahead. And so I would just go through his record collection, and he had The Clash London Calling, and that was a record that that cover obviously drew me to it, the guy smashing his bass.
Yeah.
And I put that on, and I didn't know that was punk rock. The only thing I knew about punk rock was something I saw on TV, and it showed this punk club in England, and these people were extremely punk rock. And it showed people eating red jello off of baby dolls, and they had safety pins through their cheeks. And I was like, that is not something I'm interested in at all. But so, and I didn't know that the Clash was punk rock. I just knew I liked that and I liked them, but I also liked ELO and I liked the Cars a lot. And I liked Led Zeppelin, and I hadn't really discovered Kiss yet or Black Sabbath, which I should have known about, but I just didn't have any older siblings to let me know what I should listen to. It's too bad, because there's some cool stuff that was out there that I wish I had known about earlier.
Yeah.
But FM radio was pretty good back then. They used to play Ted Nugent a lot and a lot of kind of aggro stuff. I remember seeing an ad in our local Santa Barbara paper that Black Flag was playing on State Street at this tiny little club called George's. It was probably about 50 people size capacity. It was just a tiny club. And I said, oh, that's punk rock. I wonder if they're going to have people eating jello off of babies. And I think there was kind of a, people were upset that there was a punk show happening on State Street downtown Santa Barbara, And that's why it was in the paper. They were talking about that.
So it's kind of like, ooh, stay away from that. It was like, oh, wow. Was the Pal Zone going on at that time? Was there like the indoor skate park at the Pal Peralta?
Not that early. So I lived on a really big, long downhill street called Hot Springs Road in Montecito. And Tom Sims and the early Sims team guys used to bomb that hill. And you could hear him coming down. You could hear him like half a block away. And if I was outside, I'd go running over to the fence and watch him go by. And they were going really fast. Right. And this is before hard urethane wheels. I don't think they could slide to stop. Like, I don't know how they stopped. Because there was a stop sign at the bottom and they had to fly through there. I don't think they could stop if they had to. Huh. And as far as I know, no one ever got severely injured going down that hill, but I don't know if you know who Edie Robertson is, but she was on the Sims team probably 79.
Okay.
And she held the record for 360s around that time. And her mom was my sixth grade teacher.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Her mom brought in a tape of Edie's band, and Edie was singing, and she was doing a cover of that song Precious. I think it's the Pretenders, and she says, "I'm precious, fuck off," and like she like made sure to like stop the tape right there. But that was pretty cool. And that, my grade school had a cool music program that kind of helped, like all these things kind of aligned. And you know, I had a musical background with my dad and my mom teaching me piano, and I was drawn to was drawn to music. And
was Tom Sims local then? Was he from that town? Oh, wow. Yeah.
Tom Sims was local. He had a tiny little skate shop near my high school. Huh. I actually bought my first tube amp from Tom Sims.
No way.
It was a PV Mace, like 120 watt, 212. There's several photos of me playing through that amp. It had like a built-in phaser thing. It was pretty crummy, but that's the amp that I used on probably all the Mystic stuff that I recorded. Yeah,
that rules. So I'm guessing that your parents are pretty supportive since they're already into music, and it sounded like in the early stages you guys were practicing even at your place sometimes, or creating some of the stuff. Yeah.
That's true. I mean, my dad had already left by the time I got into like playing punk rock, basically.
I mean, it's not easy to like, I used to play drums a little bit, and it's definitely not easy to like just convince people that it's okay to just not know what you're doing and learn how to play this.
Yeah, I took drum lessons, and so when I first got this drum kit, it was rad. I got home from school, probably sixth grade, and this guy was setting up a drum kit right in our foyer. We had this big old dilapidated mansion that my parents bought in Montecito. It was like haunted, crazy haunted, like falling apart mansion. It was, I don't know, it's indescribable kind of. But so I just walked in like, whoa, this guy's setting up a drum kit. And I was just kind of talking to him about it. He goes, "You like it?" I'm all, "Yeah, it's great." He goes, "Cool, because it's yours." And I was like, "No way." And so I was super stoked on that. And for a long time, I played it in my bedroom. I had a 70s like stereo with big old speakers. I would just turn on like, you know, Zeppelin or the Cars or Cheap Trick or something and play along. But I remember at one point, my dad got sick of it, and he said, I want you to move the drum kit down into the basement." So this is a big, creepy old house, and the basement was extremely frightening place to go. And I set up the drum kit down there, and I probably practiced twice, and I just gave up. It was too scary down there. I'd be like looking around, and
What was the first band? Do you remember what your first show was? Like who you saw live first?
Oh yeah. Well, the first real concert I ever went to was The Knack.
Okay.
The Knack at this big venue in UCSB. And I remember the Rubber City Rebels played that show, and they were pretty punk. They were kind of a punk band. Mm. This one local kid, he was probably Santa Barbara's first punk rocker. His name was Chris Syphilis, and he was in a band called the Strap-On Dicks. And I saw him walking down the aisle, and he had a leather jacket that said "Fuck the Knack" on the back of it, and I was like horrified by that because I loved the Knack. And but I realized, you know, I mean, there was a big backlash when My Sharona came out, and the Knack were a hit, like number one Billboard band all of a sudden, because they were sort of a new wave band that like a lot of punk rockers probably were into, and then they felt betrayed because all of a sudden this band was all mainstream. So, but at the time I thought that guy was a dick.
Yeah,
he probably was. I don't know. I've asked a lot of people if anyone knew him, and so far I've never met anyone that really knew that guy. But
That's
he was funny. Like the first real punk rocker I ever saw.
Okay. When do you remember going to a live show and looking at it a little differently? Like looking at more as like, that is what I want to do. I want to be up there. And that dude rips.
I think the first band that really blew my mind was the Battalion of Saints. I saw Battalion of Saints this venue called the Vex, I think it was. And it was in East Los Angeles, I think. It was Soto Street. I don't know. It was a pretty crummy neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
I remember when we pulled off, it was all the billboards were in Spanish. And I was like, uh-oh. This is a different situation than I'm used to. And so we went to this club, and this guitar player, Chris Smith, he had this crazy bleached hair that stuck straight up like 6 inches, and he played this Stratocaster, and he was playing like Jimi Hendrix style solos over hardcore music. And I was like, oh, that's it, I'm getting a Stratocaster, and I wanted to be like him. But I mean, before that I was super into Rick Nielsen and Cheap Trick, and I saw Cheap Trick as a young kid, and I definitely wanted to be that, you know. He had the Checkerboard Explorer, and
yeah,
I was super into checkerboard stuff, and I wanted to explore really bad. I didn't get one until 2006, but that, I used to go to the music store and, can I pick up the Explorer? And they had like a nice Dean Explorer. That was the same kind that he had. And it was like as big as me.
Oh, shit. Did you guys end up going to LA a lot, or did Santa Barbara have a pretty good, like a venue that would get a lot of traffic, or if the good bands, would you have to go into LA?
Okay. So Golden Voice did all the big shows basically back then.
Uh-huh.
And it was really difficult for a band from Santa Barbara to get Golden Voice shows. Our first show was with Agent Orange at this place called the Goleta Community Center.
Wow.
I think it might have been our first Golden Voice show, but it for sure was our first Santa Barbara big real show. And we were like opener, and I don't think anybody remembered us playing there, but it was exciting for us. But yeah, I think just being from Santa Barbara, people from LA did not see us as a legitimate band. They're just like, oh, they're a bunch of surfer kids from Santa Barbara. And that was true. You know, when my friends would take me down to see shows in LA, I was kind of terrified. Those shows were brutal and just not huge. And the cops would come in with batons, and there's always fights, and people lying on the ground after everyone left. And it was gnarly. LA was, there's all these punk gangs, and it was just a brutal place to go.
Yeah, I can't.
I was, you know, so young, and I It was just, for me, I would go because I felt like I almost obligated to go, but and I was excited about seeing the bands, and I saw some great shows down there, but it was kind of scary sometimes.
Huh. Well, so you guys played your first show with Agent Orange?
That was our first, like, real Golden Voice show. We played several smaller shows. There was, so Santa Barbara had the, back then, I think the only real punk venue was the Goleta Community Center. It was a little later, this other venue called Casa de la Raza opened, and that was a pretty cool place. And that's where RKL played our last show with the original lineup with the Ramones. And that was like after the Reseda show. We played that big Reseda show after we had gone to Europe, and there's kind of this gap. It was weird. Like, so we had a really hard time getting shows. Even after Keep Laughing came out, we toured the States, and all the shows were just, you know, teenage promoters at the local veterans club or whatever, and they're just horrible shows. I mean, there were some good ones, and we got to play a few shows with Subhumans and stuff, and we played CBGB, a Sunday matinee with that Scream, and there were some highlights for sure, and but a lot of the shows were just canceled or just horrible, like just no sound system, no promotion, no security, no organization, nothing.
Right. Fuck, dude. That's insane. Cause when Keep Laughing came out for us, it was like a really important album. Like it was like we played it a lot nonstop for whatever. And I remember, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there was a pizza parlor in Redwood City, which is the city I went to high school in. And they had punk shows. You guys played there. It was called I always get it mixed up with the Covered Wagon, I think was in SF.
Yeah, it was.
There was a Pony Express. Pony Express Pizzeria, and they had punk shows. And they had little, like, ladies that went around with flashlights. And if you were slam dancing, they'd hit you on the back and say, no, 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 no. But you guys played there. DRI played there. There was at least a year or two where we got like some bands coming through there, and our local band was Discontent, and they were basically Redwood City's RKL. Like they pretty much stole your, like you'd be like, wait, if we put our lyrics on that song, that's dead, you know, or like whatever. So you guys were a huge influence for sure. So
yeah, I remember I liked going to Redwood City.
Climate best by government test. That's our slogan down there. When was it that you guys, before you even got the shows and stuff, like what made it seem like a band is reality for you? Like you at first, I'm guessing you guys were just jamming together and throwing ideas, and then does like a song come together and you're like, I really like this song, we should do more of this? Or like what sparks it?
I think we had a handful of songs the first week we were together. We were practicing in my bedroom. Bomber just started writing songs right away. I already had a handful of songs in. But the first song we ever played with Jason singing was Bloodstains.
From Agent Orange.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And then we played, I think, Problem Child, Wasted Youth song. And our very first practice with Jason was because of Joey Cape from Lagwagon, because we thought we needed a second guitar player. And so we asked Joey, like, Bomber was like, you know any other guitar players? It'd be cool to have two guitars. I go, yeah, my friend Joey plays guitar. So I got a hold of him, and he said, yeah, I'll do it only if my friend Jason can sing. And I go, oh, I know Jason. And we were on the same soccer team. And Jason came over, and Jason was super into it. I don't think Joey was into it he was more into metal at that point.
Uh-huh.
And we were probably not up to his technical skills at that point.
Is he a little older?
He's like 6 months older than me.
But he'd just been doing
it. But he and his friends were super into metal. Like,
okay.
And we listened to Iron Maiden, and that was about the extent of it. Like, I think, you know, Joey and his friends would go to LA and look for the newest, you know, metal every weekend and stuff like that. So they were super into it. They went to concerts all the time. But we played a lot of, you know, living room party, you know, house parties, and they almost always got broken up before we could even play or before we finished. But there was a place in Isla Vista on the UCSB campus called the Red Barn. Hmm. And you could rent it out for $100, and you could even bring in your own kegs of beer and sell cups and everything. And we almost never had any problem with the cops there. And we had several shows there with several bands. A lot of hardcore bands came there, a lot of out of town. Like, I know Scream played there. There's some big bands that actually came through there. It was a great little venue. And I don't know how they handled insurance or anything, but as far as I can remember, no one got really hurt there. There was no stage or anything. It might have been like 6-inch.
Oh, right.
And no one's like jumping off stages.
I mean, Isla Vista's kind of always seemed like no rules. It's just college.
Well, the cops there were super gnarly. Like, when they decided to mess with you, they were pretty brutal. The foot patrol would beat people, and yeah. But for some reason, I just remember not really ever having problems at the Red Barn, and that was like really beneficial venue for Santa Barbara punk bands to have. Yeah, because Golden Voice did all the shows at Casa de la Raza and at the Goleta Community Center. Like, I saw some big shows there. I saw, you know, TSOL played there several times. Wasted Youth played there. Circle Jerks, Bad Brains came through there. I saw GBH there. I saw the Misfits played there. I was at that show.
Wow. Like,
I was a little kid, and those guys looked huge when they walked through, and they had those huge spikes, and I was just like, oh my God. my first real punk show was at the Goleta Community Center, and that was DOA. Mm. And my mom brought me there, and I had like a button-up shirt. We used to all buy button-up shirts at the thrift store and draw stuff on the back. And I remember I went in the pit, my first time ever in the pit, and I was right at elbow level, my face. And so I got elbowed in the nose, and my nose was just gushing blood, and I just let the blood go down my shirt. I thought that was cool. And all these people were just staring at me like, what the hell is up with that kid? And I was like, yeah. So that was like my first real punk experience, actually.
Damn. That's Misfits at a young age is pretty like eye-opening for sure.
I didn't really know their songs and all. I guess I probably did, but I just remember it was so loud and it sounded just like that's all you could hear.
Right.
And the vocals.
And so like the story is that you guys went to play or something and didn't have a name, and somebody had labeled you guys as, oh, they'll never amount to anything. They're just a bunch of rich kids on LSD.
That's true.
And yeah, so
we were called Social Revolt before that.
Oh, that was your working name.
We had never played yet, but that was the name we had decided on.
Uh huh.
But so, then, yeah, RKL. Someone told us that. Oh, Tom was saying you guys are never going to amount to anything. That you're just a bunch of rich boys on LSD. And then said, well, let's go with that. That's cool.
Were you guys doing a lot of LSD at a young age?
It's possible.
It's possible. I like when I asked Jason that in the interview, he's like, I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment. Huh. So that's insane. I mean, from talking to you guys over the years, it seems like you definitely didn't feel at the time what you felt later in life about the band. The band definitely got recognized later in your eyes, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, in Santa Barbara, we were as a big fish in a little pond, and
right,
you know, people would go to any party we played, and we had a pretty tight group of friends, you know. Dead Ted's house was like the mecca of all our punk friends, and it was right next to Santa Barbara High School, and a lot of, you know, you could go down there anytime and you'll probably run into somebody looking for something to do. But it was just like outside of Santa Barbara, even Oxnard, I don't think we were recognized as legit just because we were from Santa Barbara. And the only thing people knew about Santa Barbara was like Ronald Reagan was from there. And
they got Michael Jackson's house somewhere out there. Were you guys friends with Ill Repute and Stalag 13 and Dr. No, any of those Oxnard bands?
We were,
bands?
All of them, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Aggression was probably the first punk band, hardcore band I ever saw. I went to a party in Oxnard with some friends, and it was Aggression and MIA, which was Oxnard MIA.
Uh-huh.
They were kind of like a TSOL-style kind of gothy punk band. I really liked them. They were cool dudes. And Stalag. And so we used to go, going back to the LA thing, like it was really hard to get Golden Voice shows in LA. But there was this club called the Café des Grands, and it was right half a block away from Mystic Records. And you could just make a phone call and say, hey, you got any days open? And they say, yeah, we got Thursday, you know, the 17th. And you go, okay, put us down, we're RKL, we'll bring some friends. And they're, okay, great, you're on, you know. And so it was kind of like that. It was super, you know, there was no guarantee anyone would show up, but you were supposed to try to bring in your own crowd, and you didn't get paid or anything. But that's how we got involved with Mystic, because Philco and Doug Moody would come to the shows there and kind of scout out new punk bands. Mm. We played there. I think the first time we ever played there, Philco said, hey, we're doing, you know, I'm Phil from Mystic Records. Would you like to come see our office and our recording studio? We'd like you guys to record some songs for a compilation, the Gnarcore compilation, in these bands. You know, you mentioned, I think, Aggression and Dr. No. And we were like super stoked on that. We had already recorded two real demos, but before, like, the only way to get our music to people was on cassette tapes. We would just give them out to people at shows and stuff.
What was the first song you recorded?
Like for the demo stuff?
Yeah.
Probably Not Guilty or something, one of those songs that was on Gnarcore.
Did you guys do it, or did you pay and have somebody, was it like, what kind of recording was it?
We used to record on a boombox at our practices and give those tapes out to friends. We actually got a fan letter somehow from one of those recordings, but then we found this place in Ventura that would record 8 hours for $100. And so we did that two times. We had two different demos. And one of the demos, actually, there's this DJ on our local FM station called K-Tide, which is full on like classic rock station. But this one guy had a program that he played punk and new wave stuff. His name was Fear Hypo. And he somehow, I don't know how we got this, but he let us all come into the studio, and we had our tape on reel to reel. We still hadn't even copied it to cassette yet. Like, we had come straight from Ventura, and we went straight into the studio. We played our demo over the air on the FM radio, but I think we actually left the tapes there and never got them back. So that demo, there's the only recordings, the only copies of that demo were from people that recorded it off the radio. that night. So there's some really bad copies of like two or three songs out there.
Have you ever gotten it emailed to you or anything?
Like, I have like two copies of two songs, maybe not complete songs. The first demo came out way better. Jason's voice was so high and aggro, and the second demo, Jason drank literally like 20 beers before it was time to do vocals, and we had to put up a podium between him and the mic because he kept falling into the mic, and it was kind of a disaster, but you know, good story.
So in those moments, like as a kid, are you kind of like, fuck it, we're just having fun? Or are you a little more musician oriented where you're like, dude, we're trying to do something rad. What the fuck? Like, what are you thinking when you're looking over at that?
We were upset. I mean, $100 was a lot of money for us. And right. Yeah, we were upset that he was flailing on the vocals. But I mean, Bomber was the perfectionist in the band. And I was kind of like the quiet guy, but I would, you know, I was kind of the glue that always held things together when people got upset or whatever. And
you were the middleman, the mediator?
Kind of, yeah. Like, I think that there are many times the band probably would have broken up if it weren't for me.
That's a hard place to be.
Yeah.
Fuck. Well, talk about Bomber's, Bomber obviously is one of the hugest influences with the drums in a lot of what's going on today and what exploded in the, you know, later to be whatever you want to call it. But where did all his background and stuff come? Was his learned by himself or was he taught? Or
his older sister, she was super into, like, you know, Ted Nugent and Kiss and hard rock stuff, and Bomber's favorite drummer was John Bonham. So he loved Zeppelin, and you'll hear a lot of that influence if you really think about it. Cause John Bonham would throw a lot of these double, like super quick double kick stuff. And he wasn't using a double kick pedal. And like a lot of people over the years have always thought that Bomber was using a double kick pedal, but he didn't. He had that super fast right foot. Because he did the punk beat, the SoCal beat, whatever people call it, but he did it more differently than just about anybody does. I mean, it was he threw in these like little, like those double kick things where that most people just stick to the like constantly, but he was like booped it. Like these, like full on Bonham, like,
right,
like things. And, you know, Bomber was the genius behind a lot of our stuff. Without him, I don't think we would have lasted more than a couple of years. But he's a good part of the reason why we stood out from a lot of the other thrash bands in Santa Barbara, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Jason's voice, nobody really had that growl like him, except for maybe like Darby Crash, you know.
Yeah. And he also had the charisma where he could, like, I mean, he was a funny guy that knew how to like just totally get people involved, and he was a snowboarder. Did he have a ramp in his backyard?
Yeah, he had the Cito ramp. That thing was massive. There's tons of video and photos of that ramp. And I was there when they built it. I don't know where the wood came from, but
probably same place our ramp wood came from.
That thing was huge. It was, I think, 20 feet wide and 8 feet high. It was massive. And they did it right. That thing was built really well.
Okay.
A lot of pros came by and skated that ramp.
Where was that? What city was that in?
It's in Montecito. It's part of Santa Barbara. That was his parents' house. They let him build it in their backyard.
How long did that go for? Do you know?
It was probably there 2 years, maybe less. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it must have been a pain to disassemble that thing. He was big.
And what's the story with Josh Brolin? Was he in the band? Is that a joke? He was a friend. Like,
he was a friend of ours. He was on, I think he might've been on one of my soccer teams too, but him and Jason were friends before I met him. And I think Jason used to go to his house and they would, I bet Josh had a drum kit there. Jason probably played bass or something. Huh. In a recent interview, Josh said that I wasn't actually in RKL, but I was in a band with Jason called Cito Vice Squad. So that could be the real story behind it. But him mentioning RKL in interviews hasn't hurt us any.
At all.
Although I've never met anyone that said they bought a record because of Josh Brolin. But
right. Huh. Yeah, that was interesting because my friend that's a pro skater is actually like his mom married Josh Brolin, like second wife or whatever. So I was filming, his name's Jimmy Wilkins. Uh-huh. He's like one of the best vert skaters of this generation. He's amazing. Wow. So we were filming and he mentioned that. And I was like, wait, I kind of know those guys. Like, and then I saw it was like on the Wikipedia page or something. I was like, wait, was he just in for one show? And he gets like, what was
the
story?
So his mom married Josh?
Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. Like, yeah. So pretty crazy one. So Mystic put out Keep Laughing, right?
Well, they put the Nardcore comp. Uh-huh. And so their thing was they put as many bands as they could on a comp. And then judging by the fan mail that came back, they would do a 7-inch. And the 7-inches were 33 RPM. So you could fit 6 songs on a 7-inch. Yep. So that was our Beautiful Feeling 7-inch. And if that did well, then they'd do a 12-inch, and we did all three. And we did a couple other comps. We did the Slimy Valley comp and a covers comp. We did the, what song was it? Anyways, we were on a few Mystic comps and stuff. And, you know, at the time, nobody else would have signed our crummy band. So it was kind of a blessing. I mean, I know that over the years, we've talked a lot of shit about Mystic Records and no, they don't pay their bands. But I've recently heard some interviews with Doug Moody, and he claims that the contracts that these bands all signed say that they were only to be paid in Mystic merchandise, and that it said it on the contract. We were underage when we signed the contract, but
yeah. And looking back, you don't know how much you were paying attention to or anything. I mean, a lot of it's like skating where you're just like, dude, I'm stoked. Let's go. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. It's all going to work out. Right. I mean, I don't know.
Someone tells you to sign a contract and they're going to give you free bearings or wheels or something. Of course. Yeah.
We'll send you to Philadelphia tomorrow. I'm there. And what about the Beanie Boy and Dan Seitz? Is that all around the same time?
Yeah, it was all before Beanie Boy was around before Mystic. We met Danny from our high school. I think he was from Bakersfield, but me and Jason came up with the Beanie Boy idea, and there's a lot of controversy about who came up with the first Beanie Boy, but I was there and Jason drew the first one. It's because me and him were discussing, remember that old cartoon Beanie and Cecil? And we, that was kind of cool. And, you know, that might be cool if we had the Beanie Boy like as our mascot, because he had a propeller on his head. So it's kind of like LSD, you know, like take a trip with your head. And so that was where the Beanie thing was part of us. It was just like, take a trip inside your head because you have a propeller on your head, you know? Uh-huh. And so, I'm pretty sure Jason drew the first one. Bomber probably drew a couple, but when Danny drew it, we're like, oh yeah, he had that sinister look on his face. And that like really captured our attitude, especially like Jason's attitude.
Yeah, it was the 1-2. And was Jason writing the lyrics or were you guys all writing lyrics?
Mostly Jason and Bomber. Bomber wrote a lot of the lyrics for that Rock and Roll Nightmare record was almost probably 95% all Bomber. Bomber, right.
Bomber played bass on that too, right?
He played bass and drums, and he wrote like pretty much the entire record. He got sick. He got hepatitis and was stuck at home for like 3 months, and he wrote that record during that time.
Amazing.
He used to call me on the phone and go, listen to this. He'd go, he would like actually mouth the drums to me and all the guitar parts and everything. And like, and I'd just be like, oh my God. But I'm sure most of it was genius, you know?
I know. Jeez. I remember first time hearing that record and being like, whoa, they went from this to just like, I mean, it's kind of punk rock Rush. It's just like so, yeah. So instrumentally, like it's really amazing. And the fills of the bass, I mean, we'll get into it, but when Joe joins the band, it's just perfect for him to do those, you know, yeah. It's like incredible. I don't know which songs are the ones, but there's those breaks where it's just like,
there's video of Joe's first show with us at the farm, the day at the farm, I think it was, and playing like Blocked Out, and you know, he's never looking at his bass and he's playing that little red thing and his fingers are going like this. I'm like, what are you playing right there? And he goes, I don't even know. He just had this like on button and it was just go. And it was crazy.
Oh, wow. So that was interesting because Joe, I grew up with, well, I didn't grow up with him, but I met him like in high school and we became skater friends and worked at Go Skate in San Mateo.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly, I was talking to him recently when I was trying to get this all going and I was like, I can't remember how it all came about. You guys might've even put an ad on Craigslist for all I know, but somehow word got out. RKL is looking for a bassist and Joe's an amazing bass player at that time. He's a really gifted kid, like artist, skateboarder, whatever he did really well. And I remember I drove him up. I don't know if it was the first or second rehearsal, but I remember like we went up and I think it was maybe on Fell, like by the Panhandle.
Yeah.
And
it was Barry's upstairs apartment.
Yeah. And
above
I
the
mean,
liquor store.
I just want to hear your guys' reaction to like what you thought the first time you saw, like when he came in, were you like, oh, this is going to work? Or like,
I wasn't there the first two times that Joe showed up. And I think this was before Craigslist was even a thing. There was a flyer.
Maybe I'm dating myself.
There was a flyer and one of his friends ripped it off the wall and gave it to Joe and said, you have to do this. And, and that's how we were kind of looking at Mikey Offender from The Offenders. He was pretty interested. But The Offenders was already a band and we didn't want to steal somebody from some other band.
Right.
And he just immediately, our songs were not super easy to play. And those Rock and Roll Nightmare songs. And I guess Joe was already kind of knew about our band and stuff. So
yeah,
his friends convinced him to come up and Bomber told me on the phone that, oh, we found someone, this kid's awesome. And
yeah, him and Bomber clicked. I think it was it must have been Bomber and Barry then that were there.
I wasn't there. I don't remember what I was doing. I was probably down at my grandmother's or something.
How did you guys end up linking with Barry? What was the connection there?
I can't remember who met him first. I think Bomber must have met him first, but Barry's our connection to Europe kind of, because he went to Europe as a just on a whim, I guess. I'm not sure. He just went there to go party. his passport photo had a bozo haircut. So he only had hair sticking out on the sides and was totally shaved down the middle. And he still had that passport the first time RKL went to Europe. So like we used to have to go through the border every time we went through Eastern Germany to get to Berlin. And sometimes they would hassle people, but they'd see that passport and just start laughing and just let us go. But so that trip, he went to Europe. This is before we met him. he met Dave Pollack from Destiny Records, and Dave had told him, hey, if you know any great good bands that I could bring over to Europe, any good punk bands, let me know. And I don't know. Yeah, I think Bomber it was definitely Bomber that met Barry. Oh, you know what? Actually, this is what happened. So there's this brewery, the Hams Brewery in
where the Vats
lower
were?
Mission.
Yeah.
Was the Vats. That was the Vats. And so MDC practiced there, DRI practiced there.
Mm.
I think probably Barry's band, Morally Bankrupt, might have practiced there. And I don't know how we ended up there, but I think Jason or Bomber said, hey, we got to go up to San Francisco and play. And when I heard about this place, we can go stay. And we went up there and we went to the Vats and we met MDC, and that's where we met Barry. And he set us up with a room we could stay in, and we got to practice there. And the next night we played at Mabuhay Gardens on we got a show probably with DRI. I can't remember, but
yeah, sounds about right. DRI was playing almost every weekend. Yeah,
and Barry was in DRI before he moved to San Francisco.
Oh, he really?
Got kicked out, but yeah. I don't know why he got kicked out.
So when you guys came to SF, were you coming up there kind of like an extended stay, and it just became we're going to live here?
No, when we first came up there, we just wanted to play out of town, and we heard that there was a much better scene up there to play. Santa Barbara was getting really bad. There was like nowhere to play. We could only play the Red Barn so many times, and we couldn't get any shows in LA.
Mm.
And everyone was telling us just to go up to SF. So we just went up there. We just drove up there to this Vats place, and someone got us on a show. And we came back again like a month later. And Barry came down for some reason when we recorded the 7-inch, and he's the one that had the tape with Spock on it, you know, with the,
yeah,
seemed to be in a state identical to that curious 20th century earth disease called hard drug abuse.
He had that tape, and we put that on the record. And he also, there's a crank call that was Barry's voice saying, can I describe my penis to you? And she give it to you, goddamn mama, little damn punk.
Yeah.
So that was Barry's contribution to that record. And he didn't actually join the band till after Keep Laughing came out.
Okay. So he wasn't on that recording.
No, but just his tapes were on there, and his voice was on there on that crank call. But he played all over. I mean, he played the entire Rock and Roll Nightmare record.
Uh-huh.
He was in the band for a while by that time.
What like is special to you about the city? What did you love about it?
Well, at the time, I mean, it's so different from Santa Barbara. I wasn't into how cold it was there.
Yeah,
coming from
imagine.
Santa Barbara, I was bummed about that. And I wasn't super stoked about moving up there, but I didn't really have a choice because my mom had moved up there and Bomber moved up there. And the only person that didn't move up there was Jason, and he never lived there. He hated it up there, kind of. Right. He liked playing up there, but he had his group of friends, his clique in Montecito. He was like a Cito rat, and he was the king of his little clan of party people down there. So he had it made down there, and he still had his parents down there and stuff. So it just never appealed to him. And so, you know, the band was in San Francisco and Jason was in Santa Barbara, and we would practice 3 times a week or more, and we were just trying to get tighter and tighter, and we just wanted to be a monster band, you know. We wanted to be like the Bad Brains or something, you know, something
right.
That would leave people with the jaws drop kind of band. And you know, Jason's just charisma and the way he just kind of Darby crashed all over the whole thing was kind of the magic of it all.
Mm. Were you playing like Mabuhay, the Farm was brought on Broadway there?
Rock on Broadway, the
yeah.
Stone, the I-Beam, the Viz. We played, I mean, over the years, there's tons of clubs we played Clubfoot in CW.
Were you playing Gilman, like East Bay too?
Played Gilman maybe three times, I think.
Uh-huh.
They weren't huge fans of us, but...
No. San Jose?
But they... In San Jose, we played... The venues seemed to change down there quite a bit. We weren't regulars down there.
Okay.
But we played there. There's a pretty good video of RKL in the later years playing there, like 95 probably. We were playing the Riches to Rags stuff. And there's actually a pretty good sounding video on YouTube of us playing that place.
Rad.
But I can't remember what it was called.
I mean, the day on the farm is pretty, like, that was kind of an iconic day. I think they had two or three or four of those. You guys probably played the second or the third one, I think.
I'm not sure which one it was.
Day of the farm.
They had more than one camera going, and yeah.
The farm was so sick for us because, like I said, we live in the peninsula, and the 7F would get onto the freeway and drop you off right at the farm. It was the first. It was the first exit when they got off the freeway into the city. So it was like, boom. And we used to come up every, like I said, every Friday was DRI, Verbal Abuse, and then like four other bands. Like it was just like, felt that way anyway.
Do you remember before the Embarcadero Freeway collapsed and used to be able to get off at Broadway Street?
Yeah, no, for sure. We would go to shows over there too, Broadway and Mabuhay. And yeah, before the freeway, no one to this
you just stay in the right lane and you end up right there.
Yeah, that's my zone now. I walk over there in the mornings with my coffee and stuff and cruise by there, and it's a trip. It's a ghost town after COVID, but
yeah, for sure.
So when was the first time you guys went to Europe as a band? Was that the Keep Laughing tour?
88. So, Rock and Roll Nightmare was already out.
Oh.
Yeah, it was so 88, and we already had fans there. Alchemy Records was based out of England, so that people knew about us more there than they did in the States.
Right.
Our last tour that we had done in the States was with Beyond Possession, and it was kind of a horrible tour, just like a disastrous. So, you know, we got offered this Europe tour, and like we were playing these pretty decent, you know, 300 capacity packed places, playing big old squats and, you know, all traveling different city every night. It was all we got fed, and we always had at least somewhere to stay. It might not have been nice, but
right.
It was incredible. We went back there in 89 and did it again, and we didn't do, I don't think we did anything in the States in between, or maybe just a couple shows, but we didn't try to tour the States again until after that. But that was when, after 89, Bomber was starting to feel like Jason's vocals were slowing us down, because he wanted us to be more like, I don't know, Living Color or something, like more bluesy hard rock kind of funk stuff. And that's when the whole Reactivate era of the band came about, and you know, Jason was kind of busy in his Montecito world doing partying basically, and
that was so, a weird era where it was like, and then the other, and then you didn't know who's in what band. It was almost like just, it was very weird.
Yeah, that Reactivate record was a mistake for sure. I mean, we weren't even really a band. We had just got Dave on drums, and he hadn't really played our style of punk before. And he was in the band like 1 month, and here we are recording an album, and it wasn't even really punk. It was more funk metal, and I don't know. And so we were, the band was called Slang at the time. And
that's right. Yeah.
And then Brett and Bomber said, Brett was telling Bomber, you know, you're RKL. You could just call this RKL, you know, you're the band. And so Bomber, of course, ate that up. And I, you know, I just kind of went with whatever. I didn't realize what a mistake that was. But it was a pretty big mistake, and people would constantly, like, when we went back to Europe is that version of RKL. It was like, oh, I like very much your first records, but this record I think is shit. You know, as the Germans don't hold back when they give you those backhanded compliments, and that was common.
Oh my God!
That was the tour that our roadie and our good friend Will didn't show up in the morning when we were supposed to leave, and it turned out that he had died in the park that night. It was really horrible and emotional, and Bomber said, "That's it, I'm going home." And so, we thought, well, fuck that. We're already here, and we have all these shows set up, and let's just call Jason and see if he wants to come out. And we called him, and he said, "Hell yeah!" And he came out, and he was totally strung out on dope. But we played one show in Barcelona. And then we went out to Mallorca Island for him to detox, because we were pretty sure he couldn't score out there. And we ended up playing a show in Mallorca. We were the only American punk band besides the Ramones to ever play Mallorca at that time.
Wow.
And then we came back and did a tour, and then we came home and we wrote Riches to Rags. And then, we were starting it. We had a big kind of fire under us. We were doing really well. And then we took some time off, and Jason got back into drugs, and everything fell apart. We did one more Euro tour, but by the end of that tour, we were like done pretty much. Then we got home, and we're still writing music, but we were thinking maybe we needed to find a new singer. And I kept sending demos down to Jason, hoping he would be motivated to come back and do stuff. And eventually he did sing on those demos, but it was much later, like a couple of years after we recorded them. And those are the demos that you might have heard, like that Made in Goleta song is on there. And there's like four or five songs that he actually sang on, and they came out really cool.
NoFX and Fat Records going, and all that stuff had started happening.
Lagwagon was the first band on Fat, and that was 1989, I believe, or maybe 90.
Oh, wow.
So we had already gone to Europe twice by then, and we were about to break up, essentially. I think Reactive A came out in 92 on Epitaph. And then Bomber somehow organized Epitaph to license Rock and Roll Nightmare, because that record was no longer available to anyone.
Uh-huh.
Alchemy Records dissolved, I believe. After Bomber left the Reactive 8 version of RKL, he went on to form The Other. And they were actually signed to Epitaph. And they recorded a record. It's the musicianship and the songs are awesome, but it was never released. The sound quality was kind of crummy. It could have been remixed probably, but. And then we, at the same time, recorded the Riches to Rags album. And then we did some touring. Yeah, that was, that was 95. Something like that, 95.
Who wrote most of Riches to Rags? Did you write most of that?
Me and Joe wrote a lot of it, and Barry wrote some of it too. And Jason did almost all the lyrics.
Okay. Man, so looking back, like, is it hard to even figure out between, like, when you think of the band without Bomber and the band without Jason?
Mm.
is it kind of like you just needed them both and you needed them both to get along? And like,
I think we were doing pretty well without Bomber during the Riches to Rags era. I mean, a lot of people like that record, and it was hard. And we knew we had to live up to, we had to have something comparable to Rock and Roll Nightmare. So we tried to make that record really gnarly. And, you know, I'm pretty proud of that record. But yeah, Bomber and Jason, Bomber just had a different vision than sure. we did. And he thought we could, you know, in his mind, these songs were probably way gnarlier than the way we played them. And, you know, he was like a musical genius, you know.
Yeah, I could imagine. What was the, do you remember the first Europe trip that Joe went with you guys? Like, was he pretty green? Like, did you have to help him through some of like the different things of being a band on the road and stuff out there?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't in the band very long before we went to Europe. Pretty,
yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah,
he basically, his parent was, I just saw a photo of us at the airport. His parents were like sending him off. I think they're like almost crying. And
hope we see you.
They had to sign a document that said Barry was Joe's legal guardian because he was a minor. He was 17. He pretty much embraced it. He was on fire on that, both of those tours.
Oh, he must have been. I mean, that's a dream come true for him. He's just like, plug me in.
He skated everywhere too. And we got to skate. There was this empty pond at the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
It had these cool banks everywhere. And I went back there several times and tried to figure out where it was because I've never seen it since then. But there's some cop chasing him around on foot. And he was just like, like doing little ollies and stuff. And it was pretty funny. But yeah, there's a picture of Joe ollieing over the band and stuff. And
right. Yeah. I've always said one of the highlights for me was I got to go down to that Santa Barbara show that you were talking about where you played with the Ramones.
Yeah.
And tell a little bit about that, because I remember, I think your drum pedal or maybe it was the hi-hat, something broke. And the Ramones wouldn't let you borrow it. So you ended up headlining, I think. Yeah.
Oh, maybe that's right. That's probably
because
what happened,
you had to go to like somebody's house and get some equipment.
And that there was actually a fight between Will, that friend of mine that I mentioned that died on tour with us. He got in a fight with the roadies from the Ramones because they wouldn't lend us a hi-hat. But yeah. Bomber, like, so we had played the Reseda Country Club. Like, that was the show we played before that Ramones show, and it had been weeks since that show. I don't think we rehearsed or anything. And Bomber's drums are like scattered all over the place. Somehow he was missing a bunch of stuff. He never bought sticks, and he hated buying cymbals. He was always like, he hated playing drums essentially, because it's such a pain to set him up and carry him around and everything. And he was starting to realize that he was a good guitar player and a good bass player and singer too. So he was like, fuck all this shit. I want to play guitar. I want to be in front, you know?
Yeah. So looking back, were you originally in Lagwagon? Were you one of the original? No,
not
you
at came all, no.
in. No,
I didn't join until 97. They had already been together, you know, 8 years or 6 years. I don't know how many, but a while. Okay.
Well, this, from my perspective, RKL is a huge influence to probably every band on Fat Records, and I think they would admit that.
I wouldn't say every band, but a lot of the California.
A lot of the main ones, maybe like NoFX, you know, some of these bands that did a lot bigger than RKL did, and I don't know what the animosity level is or what the, like, fuck, they stole our, like, all that stuff. But what I do know is when I look at the current Lagwagon, the crew, they were all in RKL.
I know. And even Joey Cape was at one of our first rehearsals as a guitar player.
I mean, it's pretty interesting to me. I wonder what kind of pride you take into that, or and what kind of, like, do you just look at it as like that was then, this is now? Or I mean, how much of it do you hold on? You guys still play Arkale songs live occasionally with Lagwagon, right?
Well, at least at soundcheck and in practice, yeah.
Uh-huh.
We actually played an Arkale song in Ventura when we just recently played there at the Punk and Drublick show. And Joey didn't sing it. We had a friend of ours come sing it, our friend Damien, and he sang for the Arcade Aliens when we went and played a show in Spain a few years back.
Huh. I mean, what would your fans tell you? What are some of the songs that are like the ones, like that if you're going to play a song for an Arcade audience, what are they wanting to hear?
I'd probably Scab on My Brain, probably, and... A lot of the Keep Laughing stuff, actually, you know, people always want to hear, I don't know, maybe even Dead Ted's, like some of the more simple stuff, actually. But, you know, with the people that are musicians probably tend to want to hear more of the Rock and Roll Nightmare stuff, you know, Blocked Out. It's like the epic song, and, you know, Break the Camel's Back. That song is insane.
Fuck, I know. The one Rumors, too, I think, kind of, that one's technically difficult to play.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. I recently went back and relearned it. There's so many, there's only one part that repeats in the whole song, I think.
I mean, you guys tour a lot, by the way, right? Like when I was trying to interview you earlier, you're like, oh, we're going on a tour. Okay, we'll do it when you get back. And you get back and be like, oh, we're going on another one. I
was last
like,
year was nuts.
Was that just because it was post-COVID and you were trying to catch up?
And we had a couple tours that we had to make up, and we're still doing that this year. We got to go to Canada and make up a bunch of shows that we canceled because of COVID. The crew got sick, band got sick.
Oh.
Two different times we canceled.
It must be gnarly. When we saw, who was that? We saw Pearl Jam at locally, and their drummer got COVID the night before, and they got a local drummer from like Marin to come in and play the set the next night.
Wow.
Wasn't I can say? Yeah. So I can't even imagine trying to tour during like, these crazy times have been really nuts.
Yeah, it's been a bummer.
How's the lessons? You're doing lessons over like FaceTime or something?
Yeah, I use Skype and Zoom.
Uh-huh.
And I started doing that when Lagwagon had to cancel a bunch of shows because of COVID, and I was actually I couldn't even go to work when I got home because I had to isolate for 10 days. And so I made a video and say, you know, I'm starting to give lessons online. At one point I had 35 students. I look back at my schedule and I was working a day job, and it was, my calendar was just like just full. But I still have like a lot of students and a lot of loyal students. It's been really great.
Yeah.
But it's Chris Rest. I'm at Chris Rest Guitar on Facebook and Instagram. And
you have a website?
ChrisRest.com has my links, but yeah, on you could DM me on Instagram or Facebook at Chris Rest Guitar.
So what was it that brought last year, right? That the live album came out. Is that a anniversary thing or is that some tracks?
It was like a year off from being an anniversary thing, but Barry discovered that we had the original tapes with the tracks separated. We had already used that recording on the DVD, the Still Flailing After All These Beers DVD. That recording is used a lot on that DVD, but we got to remix it because we found the actual tapes where the drums were separated from the vocals and the guitars. And so we got to kind of remix it. And that was the reason that we decided to put it out. And so we had our friend Justin remix it and master it. And I asked Mike if he was interested in putting it out live in a dive. And it was like pretty low overhead for him to do it. And so he was like, hell yeah. And so I was stoked that came together.
Rad. Yeah. I was listening to a couple of songs today and it's like, you can tell it's a modern arcade. It's like really tight though. It feels like.
Since we are in Holland, we might as well do Podhead, huh?
In Europe?
It was in Holland, in Eindhoven. Eindhoven.
What's your guys' favorite place to go when you're out, like, overseas? Are you, like, do you have one country that you love to keep going back to or anything?
Kind of, I don't know. Like, for a while, it was Spain was awesome. And the scene kind of changes. Sometimes when RKL first started going there, Germany was like, we played Germany all the time. But Spain had always backed us really well. England's fun because, you know, you kind of get, it's just different because, you know, you're in Europe for 2 months and you start to get sick of Europeans and being in England is kind of like, almost like being home a little bit.
Right.
But Italy was always cool to go to, and I love going up to like Norway and stuff. And during the old RKL tours, going up there, it was
beautiful.
Cool. I mean, it's just trippy. You're playing like these log cabins and weird little, you're just way up there.
Yeah.
It's just different, you know.
Or it's dark all day or it's light all day.
Yeah.
That's so crazy. I know. Yeah. I get tripped out on it. What are the, do you have some like top influential stuff like right now in this era? Is there anything that's stoking you out? Is there new bands that I should know about or just stuff that you're getting fired up? Maybe somebody that opened for you guys that you're pretty hyped on or anything?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask, but I mean, Wilhelm Scream rips. I mean, they're a band that plays with Lagwagon a lot and they're just insane, like so technical. And they're just shred and, Belvedere's great band from Canada. What else? There's some other ones that Lagwagon's played with recently that were tough bands to follow, that's for sure.
Well, what's your go-to guitar? Like if you could only take one guitar with you, which one are you taking?
My 74 custom Les Paul is my main guitar, and I bring it on every tour. I bought it in Berkeley. I bought it used. It had already had the headstock broken off, and they repaired it really well, but it needed frets. It had these 70s frets that were super flat, like jazz frets. I don't know what the purpose was, but they were horrible. And so I put, you know, nice big frets on it, and that thing's been my main guitar ever since. And the reason I bought it was because I have this 76 Les Paul Standard that I got as a kid, and it was getting thrashed, and you know, it was one of my first real guitars, and so I didn't want it to get thrashed anymore, so I kind of retired that one and bought this guitar. Well, the headstock's already been broken off. I won't care if it gets thrashed, but now I care about that guitar. It was a $900 Les Paul, and you know, could be worth quite a bit more these days. I'm not sure.
Right.
I mean, it's thrash, but it still plays really well.
Okay. Sick, dude. Well, you guys got anything coming up? Or are you chilling for a minute?
Lagwagon has Canada, Japan, and Australia this year.
Nice.
And then a Punkin Drublick show, San Francisco, I think.
Oh, are you coming to
Daly City? Yeah, I think it's Daly City. Okay. Not sure when that is.
Nice. Well, if you guys are cruising up, maybe I can come out and see y'all.
Yeah, hit me up. Cool.
I feel like it's been such a time warp of just craziness. I was talking to Joe the other day, and it was so cool because, like, you know, you have certain friends that it doesn't matter how long you haven't talked to them, but you could just pick up right where you left off and stuff. And I feel like Joe's one of those guys. We spent a lot of time together early on, but I hadn't seen him a long time. And it was just instantly like jabbing and joking around.
He's in Portugal right now.
Oh, is he?
He went to the Azores because that's where his family's from. He went there with his family to go visit where his family came from. He seems like he's really enjoying it.
I bet. It's beautiful. That's where my mom's dad is from, the Azores. Wow. Yeah. Wow. So, okay. When does he get back? You know?
I don't know. I didn't even know he's going. He just started sending photos.
All right. Well, shit. Thanks for giving me so much of your time, man. I really appreciate it. And we always end with a song. You can play any song you'd like. What would you like throw on for?
Like any song in the universe? Or
yeah, any song in the universe, any song you've done, a song, whatever.
Oh, my God. I'm on the spot.
Yeah.
Let's see. Wow, that's tough. Let's play some Germs. In memory of Jason Sears, we'll play some Germs, like Richie Dagger or something like that.
Okay, fuck yeah. Thanks, dude. I appreciate it, and be safe out there. It's crazy times.
Thanks, man.
Take care.
Well, thanks, Lee.
Okay, later.
Talk to you soon. Bye. Sorry.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talking Schmidt. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. When you subscribe, you'll get notifications every Tuesday of new episodes the minute they become available. Also, please leave reviews and a 5-star rating. It's the best way to help the show grow. All of the episodes will always remain free, but if you would like to help support the show, you can do so at talkingschmidt.com, where you can pick up some merchandise like t-shirts, beanies, hats, and stickers. The website has an entire archive of all of the episodes, with extra photos and videos. Email us with any suggestions, comments, or ways that the show may have improved your life at talkingschmidt@gmail.com. All interviews are conducted, edited, and produced by Schmitty. The intro music is Mary's Cross by the band Nature. A very special shout out goes to the executive director, Cheryl Camisa.
Shout out.
Love it!
This is Talking Schmidt, where the Rolodex is deep, but the conversation is deeper.
Keep the wheels greased.